Well, today's sermon title on the transient and permanent in parenting comes from a very famous old Unitarian sermon about the transient and permanent in religion and spirituality. But it strikes me that parenting has some things that are stylistic and some things that really, really run deep. So I want to talk about this on Father's Day today. And I'll start out by making an obvious complaint, which is fathers are portrayed usually very badly in the media and in comedy, on television, in the movies, that fathers are usually arrogant, know-nothings, sometimes bullies, sometimes passive, almost always father doesn't know best. The stereotypes seem to go, and I love the Garrison Keillor image, which was from antlers to pats of butter, that those are two extremes of how we dads are portrayed. We are career-driven and absent, or beer-driven and absent, and when we're involved, we're just wrong. Now look, I'm sure most stereotypes have some level of truth to it, but the irony, of course, is that this horrifying portrayal of men in general and fathers in particular is not launched at men by angry women. Almost everyone in the writer's room is male. And so we're doing this to ourselves. Now, it's also true that nobody looks good on television. Women are not portrayed particularly well. Mothers, not much better. Minorities, terribly. And most of the media is to reality, or at least what we think of as to reality, as our driver's license pictures, which is there's some truth there, but it's an ugly truth, and we really don't want to look at it or show it to anyone else. I think the truth is that most dads are pretty decent and really care, and while being human and make mistakes, we try, I think, more than our parents did, and we learned from them, and I hope that our children learn from us and our mistakes, to try to be involved, not to accept those old distinctions as if they were automatic about what a man's job is as a breadwinner and what a mom's job is as a cook, nurturer, and diaper changer. I remember an epiphany that struck me. Actually, it was my first wife who struck me, not physically, but just emotionally, when Adam was, about 5 or 6 weeks old, and we were visiting some congregants in my first congregation, Star King Church in Hayward, and I walked into the bedroom where we had the little kid carrier and went, and I came back out and announced, "Oh, honey, the baby's dirty." And she just looked up at me with a pleasant smile and said, "So because I'm genitally equipped differently, I like having my fingers in that. Your turn, honey." I got to tell you that that was an epiphany, because its truth was something that I had not considered. I was on an old and unexamined tape. And this opened up my eyes and taught me how to shut my nostrils all at the same time. And it changed my life. And it changed my life in so many good ways that I became a literally hands-on and hands-in father. I became a carpool father and a cooking father and not a very good cleaning father. But there were a lot of changes in all of those, for me, previously unexamined gender roles. And I think that for my cohort, this is a pretty normal evolutionary change. I still know people who say proudly that they've never changed the diaper, that they've never gone out shopping for clothes for their child, and list as accomplishments the things that they haven't done. And I think that they have been robbed of the potential for kinds of real intimacy. intimacy in the hands-on part and intimacy in the hearts-on time. Some of my deepest, most emotional memories are pacing the floor at night holding a little fevered baby. Some of my most untreasured moments are pacing the floor at night waiting for him to come home after he got his driver's license. But the kind of attachment that we of my generation got to experiment with was really life-altering for us, and I'd like to think for our children, who do not assume the same gender role stereotyping. That when my son was about 6 years old, he said, "When I grow up to be a daddy, I'm going to cook dinner too." And he does. And that's something that's different. It's nothing that I experienced when I was a child. Now, as smart and as prescient and as conscious as we were in Berkeley in the 60s, we got some of it wrong. You're laughing because even if it wasn't Berkeley, you know we got some of it wrong, and many can barely remember what those things that we got wrong were, but I think I remember some of them. One of them is that we denied that there was a difference between men and women, boys and girls. We thought it was all social conditioning. And if not all, at least it was very much nurture over nature. And if you put a bunch of boys and girls in a room and you put out the little guns and the trucks and the play stoves and the dolls, that they would just not select according to what their gender was. That didn't turn out to be the case. And that it's kind of ironic that for all of the reputation that the 60s had in terms of sex and sexuality, that one of the things that I think is most ironic is the denial of the general differences and distinctions. Now, obviously, these are only generalities. There are women physically bigger and stronger than men. There are men who are warm and nurturing and do all of the stereotypic things, and it all gets confused. I know that. But in general, we're different. Not better, not worse. I got 7 grandkids. And I didn't really understand the differences until I became, well, I still don't understand them. I didn't really notice the differences and accept them until I became a grandfather. And when I became a grandfather, because when I was a father, we had all boys. I had a boy, Helene had 2 boys, so I knew what they kind of felt like and how they fit and how they had fits, and went from birth through the teen years, and then grandchildren. And we've got 4 granddaughters and 3 grandsons. And they just fit different in the arms. They throw fits differently. They negotiate differently. Their styles are quite different. They rebel differently. They manipulate us differently. We are pats of butter for it all works. I mean, that's the thing. Everything they do works. Opens our hearts and turns our brains off, and we just go, "Oh God, yes," and give them whatever they want, as long as it doesn't involve, you know, physical danger. But to recognize that there are these differences, there are differences in general between moms and dads, and we get wonderful gifts from both sides, from both parents. And even when the parents are of the same gender, there are roles that are different and there are ways that we are different with each other. The inheritance that I got from my parents, at the time, there were times when I wasn't all that pleased to be getting some particular inheritances, twice involving spankings, but they were very different people. My mother was very intellectual and very political. My father, on the other hand, came from a long line of scholars and intellectuals, and he wasn't at all. He was a guy. He was into sports. The time that we spent in the backyard throwing the baseball around. The time that we spent at baseball games, he had season tickets to the Dodgers. He went to the racetrack and had a box at Hollywood Park. We went to football games. He took me from Ascot Park, where they raced cars, to opening day at Riverside, to the Indianapolis 500. We saw Muhammad Ali box in person twice. He was a real sports guy. Today, I have almost no interest in sports. In the high holy days of sports, I'll watch the last games of the playoffs, or if a Los Angeles or Anaheim team might be involved, I'll watch the entire playoffs. But during the season, I don't watch baseball. I don't watch basketball. I have not gone to a fight, other than a parking lot at Christmas time, intentionally, in 40 years. None of that took. What took was the time. What took was him giving his time, and whether that legacy was passed over in terms of sports wasn't important. What was important was the time that showed me his involvement and his caring and his bonding. My father taught me right from wrong, and he taught me and supported me to choose wrong from time to time. And I'm very serious about this. Some of my outstanding memories are when he encouraged me and took me out of school to share an experience. We played hooky. I was at the first Dodger game in the Coliseum. It was, I believe, on a Thursday. I sat next to Joe Louis. That was pretty impressive. The game was impressive. He took me out of school for the first day of the Dodgers at Dodger Stadium. He took me out of school for the first day of the Angels at Dodger Stadium. He told me to stay home from school on the day that John Glenn blasted off into space so that I could see that historic moment, because that would not come again. I come from a family that values education, and sometimes that's outside of the classroom. He taught me to prioritize, to examine, to own the choices that I made, and that it wasn't simply a question of blindly following rules, but the maxims of the rules, as Kant would say, the reason for the rules, to value the educational part of the rules. He encouraged me to do civil disobedience. When I was down in Watts registering voters, that was with his full enthusiastic support. And when I told him I was dating a black woman in college, he only had one question: is she Jewish? And it happened that the answer was yes, and he fell on the ground laughing and said, "Well, there you are." She went on to become a very well-known artist and scholar of black liberation and liberation theology, as well as somebody who helped me cheat in school openly. I'll tell you this story. It's not really relevant to this. Well, maybe it is relevant to the sermon, because it's about honesty. I had written a paper for comparative literature, and we're sitting in the front row, and she's looking at the paper, and she says, "John, it's a really good paper, but your spelling and punctuation are atrocious." And I said, "Well, correct it." And the teacher's standing here, and here am I, and there's Michelle, and she looks at me, and she looks at the teacher, and the teacher looks at me, and I said, "Just correct it. And then write, by Jonathan Dobra, edited by Michelle Gibbs." And the teacher thought, I'm watching the teacher go, "Well, okay." We got an A. But there was nothing sneaky about it. The point of all of this is that parenting instructs verbally, but most importantly, in an exemplary manner about our values. It's great to say I love you all the time, and I know that there are people in this room who never heard I love you from a dad, but knew that you were loved or knew that you weren't, but it was communicated in 1,000 nonverbal ways. But you can also say I love you 6 times a day and do the Harry Chapin song with the cats in the cradle and not be there. Being there as a parent, as a father, as a mother, showing what our values and our priorities are by example, is the single most powerful tool we have for building and leaving a legacy. How we spend our time on this planet is how we build and leave a legacy. Parents, grandparents, we do this sometimes. We think through our DNA. The DNA is sometimes, for some people who are not involved in the lives of our children and grandchildren, just the passing of a genetic marker. But we pass our real legacies with our values and with our time and with our experience. The important DNA for parents and grandparents and blended families and with stepchildren, step-grandchildren, with adopted children and then their children is the DNA of values that we pass on through our time, our choices, our actions, our hugs, our kisses, the love that we make with the choices that we make every day. And so to parents, biological and adopted, to parents of children who are not your own, to all the people in this room who are parents, to all of the children in this community and need to learn how to be those kinds of exemplary figures in the larger world, that's the permanent part. Our styles, whether it's Berkeley in the 60s or the East Coast or the middle of the country, our styles of parenting may change, will change. Everything that the child expert said in the 40s is nonsense in the 50s, is thrown out in the 60s. What was said in the 60s is thrown out in the 70s. We can re-examine all of the theories. Those are transient. What's permanent is the love that we show our children, our grandchildren, our families, with the time that we spend together, asking questions that we know the answer to. That was one of the other great gifts of my dad. He would ask people questions, and I asked him, why are you asking a question that you know the answer to? He said, because it gives that person a sense of being useful, a sense of being knowledgeable, a sense of being important. And we have the ability to do that with each other, with our families, with our extended families, to honor them with time, respect, and with love.